Chapter 50. Pondering on his unhappy lot, Joe sat and listened for a long time, expecting every moment to hear their creaking footsteps on the stairs, or to be greeted by his worthy father with a summons to capitulate unconditionally, and deliver himself up straightway. But neither voice nor footstep came, and though some distant echoes, as of closing doors and people hurrying in and out of rooms, resounding from time to time through the great passages, and penetrating to his remote seclusion, gave note of unusual commotion downstairs, no nearer sound disturbed his place of retreat, which seemed the quieter for these far-off noises, and was as dull and full of gloom as any hermit's cell. It came on darker and darker. The old-fashioned furniture of the chamber, which was a kind of hospital for all the invalided movables in the house, grew indistinct and shadowy in its many shapes. Chairs and tables, which by day were as honest cripples as need be, assumed a doubtful and mysterious character. And one old leprous screen of faded India leather and gold binding, which had kept out many a cold breath of air in days of yore, and shut in many a jolly face, frowned on him with a spectral aspect, and stood at full height in its allotted corner, like some gaunt ghost who waited to be questioned. A portrait opposite the window, a queer, old gray-eyed general, in an oval frame, seemed to wink and doze as the light decayed, and at length, when the last faint glimmering speck of day went out, to shut its eyes in good earnest and fall sound asleep. There was such a hush and mystery about everything that Joe could not help following its example, and so went off into a slumber likewise, and dreamed of Dolly till the clock of Chigwell Church struck two. Still nobody came. The distant noises in the house had ceased, and out of doors all was quiet, save for the occasional barking of some deep-mouthed dog, and the shaking of the branches by the night wind. He gazed mournfully out of window at each well-known object as it lay sleeping in the dim light of the moon, and creeping back to his former seat, thought about the late uproar, until, with long thinking of, it seemed to have occurred a month ago. Thus, between dozing, and thinking, and walking to the window and looking out, the night wore away, the grim old screen, and the kindred chairs and tables, began slowly to reveal themselves in their accustomed forms. The gray-eyed general seemed to wink, and yawn and rouse himself, and at last he was broad awake again, and very uncomfortable, and cold and haggard he looked, in the dull gray light of morning. The sun had begun to peep above the forest trees, and already flung across the curling mist bright bars of gold, when Joe dropped from his window on the ground below, a little bundle and his trusty stick, and prepared to descend himself. It was not a very difficult task, for there were so many projections and gable ends in the way, that they formed a series of clumsy steps, with no greater obstacle than a jump of some few feet at last. Joe, with his stick and bundle on his shoulder, quickly stood on the firm earth, and looked up at the old maypole, it might be for the last time. He didn't apostrophize it, for he was no great scholar. He didn't curse it, for he had little ill will to give to anything on earth. He felt more affectionate and kind to it than ever he had done in all his life before, so said with all his heart, "God bless you." ... as a parting wish, and turned away. He walked along at a brisk pace, big with great thoughts of going for a soldier and dying in some foreign country, where it was very hot and sandy, and leaving God knows what unheard of wealth in prize money to Dolly, who would be very much affected when she came to know of it, and full of such youthful visions, which were sometimes sanguine and sometimes melancholy, but always had her for their main point and center, pushed on vigorously until the noise of London sounded in his ears, and the Black Lion hove in sight. It was only 8 o'clock then, and very much astonished the Black Lion was, to see him come walking in with dust upon his feet at that early hour, with no gray mare to bear him company. But as he ordered breakfast, to be got ready with all speed, and on its being set before him gave indisputable tokens of a hearty appetite, the Lion received him, as usual, with a hospitable welcome, and treated him with those marks of distinction, which, as a regular customer, and one within the Freemasonry of the trade, he had a right to claim. This lion or landlord, for he was called both man and beast, by reason of his having instructed the artist who painted his sign, to convey into the features of the lordly brute whose effigy it bore, as near a counterpart of his own face as his skill could compass and devise, was a gentleman almost as quick of apprehension, and of almost as subtle a wit, as the mighty John himself. But the difference between them lay in this, that whereas Mr. Willet's extreme sagacity and acuteness were the efforts of an assisted nature, the lion stood indebted, in no small amount, to beer, of which he swigged such copious draughts, that most of his faculties were utterly drowned and washed away, except the one great faculty of sleep, which he retained in surprising perfection. The creaking lion over the house door was, therefore, to say the truth, rather a drowsy, tame, and feeble lion, and as the social representatives of a savage class are usually of a conventional character being depicted, for the most part, in impossible attitudes, and of unearthly colors, he was frequently supposed by the more ignorant and uninformed among the neighbors to be the veritable portrait of the host as he appeared on the occasion of some great funeral ceremony or public mourning. What noisy fellow is that in the next room? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Joe, when he had disposed of his breakfast, and had washed and brushed himself. A recruiting sergeant, apostrophe, replied the lion. Joe started involuntarily. Here was the very thing he had been dreaming of, all the way along. And I wish, apostrophe, said the lion, he was anywhere else but here. The party make noise enough, but don't call for much. There's great cry there, Mr. Willet, but very little wool. Your father wouldn't like 'em, I know. Apostrophe, perhaps not much under any circumstances. Perhaps if he could have known what was passing at that moment in Joe's mind, he would have liked them still less. Is he recruiting for a fine regiment? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Joe, glancing at a little round mirror that hung in the bar. I believe he is, apostrophe, replied the host. It's much the same thing, whatever regiment he's recruiting for. I'm told there ain't a deal of difference between a fine man and another one, when they're shot through and through. Apostrophe, they're not all shot, apostrophe, said Joe. No, apostrophe, the lion answered, not all. Those that are supposing it's done easy are the best off in my opinion. Apostrophe, ah. Apostrophe, apostrophe, retorted Joe, but you don't care for glory. Apostrophe, for what? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the lion. Glory. Apostrophe, no, apostrophe, returned the lion, with supreme indifference. I don't. You're right in that, Mr. Willet. When glory comes here, and calls for anything to drink, and changes a guinea to pay for it, I'll give it him for nothing. It's my belief, sir, that the glory's arms wouldn't do a very strong business. Apostrophe, these remarks were not at all comforting. Joe walked out, stopped at the door of the next room, and listened. The sergeant was describing a military life. It was all drinking, he said, except that there were frequent intervals of eating and love-making. A battle was the finest thing in the world, when your side won it and Englishmen always did that. Supposing you should be killed, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said a timid voice in one corner. Well, sir, supposing you should be, apostrophe, said the sergeant, what then? Your country loves you, sir. His Majesty King George III loves you. Your memory is honored, revered, respected. Everybody's fond of you, and grateful to you. Your name's wrote down at full length in a book in the War Office. Damn, gentlemen, we must all die sometime, or another, eh? Apostrophe, apostrophe, the voice coughed, and said no more. Joe walked into the room. A group of half a dozen fellows had gathered together in the tap room, and were listening with greedy ears. One of them, a carter in a smock frock, seemed wavering and disposed to enlist. The rest, who were by no means disposed, strongly urged him to do so according to the custom of mankind, back the sergeant's arguments, and grinned among themselves. I say nothing, boys, apostrophe said the sergeant, who sat a little apart, drinking his liquor. For lads of spirit here he cast an eye on Joe, this is the time. I don't want to inveigle you. The king's not come to that, I hope. Brisk young blood is what we want, not milk and water. We won't take 5 men out of 6. We want top sawyers, we do. I'm not a going to tell tales out of school, but, damn, if every gentleman's son that carries arms in our corps, through being under a cloud, and having little differences with his relations, was counted up here as I fell on Joe again, and so good-naturedly, that Joe beckoned him out. He came directly. You're a gentleman, by G. ... was his first remark, as he slapped him on the back. You're a gentleman in disguise. So am one. Let's swear a friendship. ... Joe didn't exactly do that, but he shook hands with him, and thanked him for his good opinion. You want to serve, ... said his new friend. You shall. You were made for it. You're one of us by nature. What'll you take to drink? ... nothing just now, ... replied Joe, smiling faintly. I haven't quite made up my mind. ... a meddlesome fellow like you, and not made up his mind. ... cried the sergeant. Here let me give the bell a pull, and you'll make up your mind in half a minute, I know. ... you're right so far, answered Joe, for if you pull the bell here, where I'm known, there'll be an end of my soldiering inclinations in no time. Look in my face. You see me, do you? ... I do, ... replied the sergeant with an oath, and a finer young fellow or one better qualified to serve his king and country, I never set my ... he used an adjective in this place eyes on. Thank you, ... said Joe, I didn't ask you for want of a compliment, but thank you all the same. Do I look like a sneaking fellow or a liar? ... the sergeant rejoined with many choice asseverations that he didn't, and that if his, the sergeant's, own father were to say he did, he would run the old gentleman through the body cheerfully, and consider it a meritorious action. Joe expressed his obligations, and continued, you can trust me then, and credit what I say. I believe I shall enlist in your regiment tonight. The reason I don't do so now is, because I don't want until tonight, to do what I can't recall. Where shall I find you, this evening? ... his friend replied with some unwillingness, and after much ineffectual entreaty having for its object the immediate settlement of the business, that his quarters would be at the Crooked Billet in Tower Street, where he would be found waking until midnight, and sleeping until breakfast time tomorrow. And if I do come, which it's a million to one, I shall, when will you take me out of London? ... demanded Joe. Tomorrow morning, at 8:30, ... replied the sergeant. You will go abroad a country, where it's all sunshine and plunder the finest climate in the world. ... to go abroad, said Joe, shaking hands with him, is the very thing I want. You may expect me. ... you're the kind of lad for us, ... cried the sergeant, holding Joe's hand in the excess of his admiration. You're the boy to push your fortune. I don't say it, because I bear you any envy, or would take away from the credit of the rise you'll make, but if I had been bred and taught like you, I'd have been a colonel by this time. ... tush, man. ... said Joe, I'm not so young as that. Needs must when the devil drives, and the devil that drives me is an empty pocket and an unhappy home. For the present, goodbye. ... for king and country. ... cried the sergeant, flourishing his cap. For bread and meat. ... cried Joe, snapping his fingers. And so they parted. He had very little money in his pocket, so little indeed, that after paying for his breakfast, which he was too honest, and perhaps too proud to score up to his father's charge, he had but a penny left. He had courage, notwithstanding, to resist all the affectionate importunities of the sergeant, who waylaid him at the door with many protestations of eternal friendship, and did in particular request that he would do him the favor to accept of only 1 shilling as a temporary accommodation. Rejecting his offers both of cash and credit, Joe walked away with stick and bundle as before, bent upon getting through the day as he best could, and going down to the locksmith's in the dusk of the evening, for it should go hard, he had resolved, but he would have a parting word with charming Dolly Varden. He went out by Islington, and so on to Highgate, and sat on many stones and gates, but there were no voices in the bells to bid him turn. Since the time of noble Whittington, fair flower of merchants, bells have come to have less sympathy with humankind. They only ring for money, and on state occasions. Wanderers have increased in number, ships leave the Thames for distant regions, carrying from stem to stern no other cargo. The bells are silent, they ring out no entreaties or regrets, they are used to it, and have grown worldly. Joe bought a roll, and reduced his purse to the condition, with a difference, of that celebrated purse of Fortunatus, which, whatever were its favored owner's necessities, had one unvarying amount in it. In these real times, when all the fairies are dead and buried, there are still a great many purses which possess that quality. The sum total they contain is expressed in arithmetic by a circle, and whether it be added to or multiplied by its own amount, the result of the problem is more easily stated than any known in figures. Evening drew on at last. With the desolate and solitary feeling of one who had no home or shelter, and was alone utterly in the world for the first time, he bent his steps towards the locksmith's house. He had delayed till now, knowing that Mrs. Varden sometimes went out alone, or with Mix for her sole attendant, to lectures in the evening, and devoutly hoping that this might be one of her nights of moral culture. He had walked up and down before the house, on the opposite side of the way, two or three times, when as he returned to it again, he caught a glimpse of a fluttering skirt at the door. It was Dolly's. To whom else could it belong? No dress but hers had such a flow as that. He plucked up his spirits, and followed it into the workshop of the Golden Key. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.